Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley, Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley, Instagram, TotalTutor, Pinterest, Neil Haley, and Google Plus, Neil Haley. And it's time for the Miami Book Fair series. More awesome interviews, but it's all to promote the great event, the Miami Book Fair, November 16th to 23rd, and the street fair is the 21st to 23rd. You got to go to MiamiBookFair.com to find out more information, and I hope that if you're a fan of books, you got to be there for sure. And this one is a very interesting one. I would tell you it's probably one of my biggest author celebrity interviews, and so I'm excited to welcome the program New York Times best-selling author, former host of TBS's Dinner in a Movie, actress Annabelle Gurwitch. Annabelle, how are you? And thanks again for calling the program.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, I grew up in Miami, and so for me, coming to the book festival is just the best. This will be my second time there. I was there with my last book, You Say Tomato, I Say Shut Up. And I always tell people, I'm really only writing books because of Mitchell Kaplan, the owner of Books and Books, who is the man behind the Miami Book Festival. I've had a crush on him since high school. He is a couple years older than me, and he wouldn't go out with me, so I went on a date with his brother. Very nice guy, but not Mitch. And I tell people I just write books so that I can be in his presence. He is still, he's just one of the great leaders of independent bookstores and keeping books alive, and he's just the greatest. So that's why I write books. that's the only reason, nothing else.
And he's showing definitely the comedy in all this, for sure. And the title of your book, as I was saying and joking around with you, as a mouthful, I see you made an effort, compliments, indignities, and survival stories from the edge of 50. And that really, in a lot of ways, that 50 hits you like a brick wall in some ways, doesn't it? For sure.
You know, there's a reason why they call it hitting middle age. They don't call it sliding in. They don't call it middle age. It's definitely a reason. And I think that one of the reasons why I wrote the book, and it's a collection of essays about these moments when you realize that things really have changed. And you know, I like to cover everything from the little to the big moments. So it's everything from, you know, the first time you get mammed for women is a very big deal. The first time you realize, and this happened to me when I walked into my Apple store, that one of the things I find sexually attractive in someone is someone who knows how to fix my computer. This is a big deal for me now. When you get that AARP email and you see those elders marching toward you in their pleated khaki Dockers, you know, these and the AARP, I believe, is a wing of the NSA because they track you down. No matter how you try to avoid it, they're going to remind you that you're about to turn 50. And then there's the health issues. There's, you know, beginning to take care of your parents when you become your own mother's mother.
Yes.
And then, of course, when you look in the mirror, you're walking through the living room and you think, what's my mother doing at my house? And you realize it's not my mother. It's me that I'm looking at. You know, there are these moments, and I really try to capture these. And the book is about status and class and how and the sort of cultural zeitgeist that we've tried to avoid. And that's why, you know, I ended up with a long title. A lot of people just call it, you know, I see you made an effort. But there are compliments, indignities, and ultimately it is a survival story because, listen, I mean, I'm grateful that I am hobbling towards the future in my athletic boot because I had what is called a boomeritis accident when you're you're exercising like you think you're younger than you are, and I twisted my ankle. They call that boomeritis now.
Really?
It's actually a name for exercising like you think you're younger than you are. So, you know, I wanted to capture these moments, and they're all, it's all in essay form. The essay is my favorite form. I have to say, there's something about an essay that I just find to be just, it's my goal as a writer to really, you know, to get better and better at that form. It's so small. It's sort of like, to me, when they're great, they're like jewels.
Definitely. As we're talking to celebrity actress and New York Times bestselling author Annabelle Gurwitch. And what's interesting, Annabelle, when you talk about anti-aging and different things that you go through, being somebody who is a public figure like yourself, you really have to be practicing those things. So you're putting yourself out there with these essays, but also you're putting yourself out there that, you know what, when you are in the public eye, and people recognize you, you constantly have to continue to, like, you've not aged, right, in certain ways. Or that's what the hope is, right?
Well, you know, I mean, the book is, and I always say I live basically Hollywood adjacent these days, you know, in the shadow of celebrity. First of all, I don't consider myself a celebrity. I'm not really interested in celebrity. I happen to have worked in this industry. You know, I've been on television. I continue to be on television. I think that all of us, though, and this is what I think creates so much anxiety, is, you know, there's real things and there's neurotic things. We don't know really how to age. And the truth is, we are living, you know, longer. We are really, you know, carving out a new position for ourselves at this age in society, and we don't really have a template for it, so we don't know. And there's all these things you can do, and do they work or don't they work? And you just feel like a jerk doing these things. I think that it comes from this real anxiety about not knowing how to age, and that's again one of the reasons why I wrote this book. And it's not, I do have a little bit of Hollywood in this book, but it's really a book about all of us heading into this future in this way where we don't have a template, and aging out of our own imagination of who we were supposed to be. So many people are on, you know, reinventors on second, third careers, marriages, yes, lives. I mean, you know, it is kind of a brave new world, and it has a lot of plastic surgery in it, but it has, you know, but for us really normal folk, it's very confusing. And I do talk about, you know, that, I don't know, the drumbeat to look young. And this is one of those indignities when you meet with someone that you grew up with for lunch, and suddenly they look so much younger than you. And you're like, what?
What happened?
That's not fair.
Well, Annabelle, when you greet people, you know, in L.A. and stuff like that might be different, but yeah, they might have a little bit more plastic surgery at times, for sure.
They actually, you know, and I include this in the book, the majority of plastic surgery takes place in people between the incomes of $30,000 and $90,000 a year. That's what I call it, the soccer momization.
Really? Oh, interesting.
But that's really a minor point of this book, because really our faces are just the tip. You know, that's just on the face of it, you know, the aging thing. I think it's so many other ways that it impacts you on a daily basis. I mean, this is what's so funny. I'm driving in the car with my husband, and he's listening to a radio station that's playing the Smiths. And I said, oh, my God, Jeff, you're listening to the oldies station. We are the oldies.
Yeah.
And you find yourself in these modes where you're trying to explain to your teenager how great it was before there were cell phones and there was caller ID, and you could call someone you had a crush on over and over, and they wouldn't know who called. You know, you begin to understand the attraction of nostalgia,
yes,
and you want to stay current, and staying current in the world increases your neuroplasticity and helps keep you, you know, your body young. But you also find yourself drawn to these things. And then, you know, I'm going through this thing right now with my parents that I write about in the book, where, you know, they're we're selling our childhood home, yeah. and they're moving on to the next phase in their life. And every week, packages are appearing at my house with champagne glasses. 24, were we a family that wanted to celebrate? I didn't remember that. We had, you know, all these, and what am I going to do? So now I've got my mother's things, and these are real moments. And I think that in our culture, we, you know, this whole canard is what I call it, of, you know, 50 is the new 40. Well, that's just not true. No, there are real things that you're going through at this age. And my book is hopefully something that, like a piece of cake, but less fattening, that yeah. will help yeah. it go down easier.
Well, see, what I find fascinating when you talked about, specifically, you think 50, and I'm 41, Annabelle, and I'm already thinking of these things specifically because we just lost my wife's father, and he died at 80, and we're just dealing with all these sort of things. I'm thinking about when my father dies and my mother, and then when we have to take care of our mothers, and then we have to do specific things. It's just, it definitely gives you that perspective of, yes, when you're going older, yeah, it's once the kids leave, everything's going to be fine. I told you about, I didn't tell you that I have 5 kids of my own, and I'm going to die. I got 5, and my youngest. Am I crazy? You see how wound up I am and tightly. No, I'm crazy to be doing 7 hours of radio and entrepreneur. Sometimes I think that, but
wow,
I love
you
it.
You are just living on the edge.
Yes, I used to live on the edge as a professional wrestler. So if 5 kids is nothing to me, to say the least. But when we talk about teenage girls, and so that when I'm 50, my first daughter will be, my oldest daughter will be in the teen years. It's a challenge, isn't it? Especially with...
Yes, well, parents of teenagers will enjoy this book because I give a whole list of things I'm not allowed to do as the mother of a teenager, which includes everything from eye contact, even chewing. I'm not allowed to chew in front. I chew too loudly, apparently.
Oh, wow.
Just the sight of my face is apparently an affront. I'm never allowed to be nude in my house within 100 feet, even if the doors are closed. There's just it's a very small window of things that you're allowed to do as a parent of a teen. And in fact, there's a story about taking my son to a concert, which I think it's a cautionary tale, I would say, for any parent. So,
which concert?
Really,
will you tell us what concert? We have to read the book to find out.
I took him to a punk rock concert. It's a band called Titus Andronicus, named for the Shakespearean play, as only a mother who was a writer would take her kid to see a band named after a Shakespeare play, which, of course, if you know the play, there's a little bit of irony there. The play is about the queen of the Goths who accidentally eats her sons that are baked into a pie. It's a disaster. And my little adventure with my son was also a disaster. So it was really quite fitting. But it was a literary disaster. And, you know, I do love a literary disaster.
Well,
gotta say.
Well, and definitely, I was thinking you said Motley Crue, because it was interesting going back to a Motley Crue
Motley
concert
Crue.
After when I went in eighth grade to the final one, and how loud it was at 41, and saying, and how some of these people were older than me, and they're like rocking it out. I'm like, they must have no hearing anymore, because I can't even
hear.
They
have no hearing anymore. That's so funny. Well, you know, it is, again, this is one of those things that I do in the book, which is, you know, making that distinction between culture now and culture when I was growing up. And so being a South Floridian, the very first concert I went to was a Jethro Tull concert at the Miami-Dade the Sportatorium. There used to be something called the Sportatorium. I don't know if it's still there. A Sportatorium. It was a sports center. It was an auditorium. It was both. And I went with a bunch of my girlfriends, and I took my son to his first concert. So he went to his first concert with his mother. Now that would never have happened in 1979.
Definitely. And the Sportatorium, I think, was the days of professional wrestling when Hulk Hogan broke in and many other famous people in the Florida territory. Back in that time.
You know, on Dinner and a Movie, when I hosted that show, because it was TBS, we had quite a few wrestlers on, and I had the privilege of having Terry Hulk Hogan on. What a great guy.
Wow. Could you find that on YouTube? That's an interesting thing. I'm going to have to search some of those things and tweet out some of those to you at times. But Annabelle, where's the best place we can find information on you, purchase your book, and learn more about you? And I know people want to visit you in Miami.
That would be great. Yeah. I believe my event in Miami is on Sunday, November 23rd at 3:00. And the schedule of where that is exactly is on the Miami Book Fair site. But if you go to my website, which is my name, Annabelle Gurwitch, and I think if you even spell it wrong on the internet, it's kind of like nobody wants that name, you'll find me. And it has dates that I have all over the country. I'm about to do a tour. I'm going to be everywhere from Michigan to Miami, New York, Connecticut.
Wow,
I will be
if
you see me in an airport, this is a great way to connect with me. Just go to hang out in airports and buy me a soy latte. That's what I'm drinking these days. That's my big vice. And we'll connect. But I am going to be on tour. At my website, you can see clips of me with my friend Bill Maher on his show, with Charlie Rose on CBS, talking about the book. It has links where you can get the book and read excerpts. And you can come out and see me around the country. There's nothing more satisfying. This has been an interesting thing for me, going from being an actress to being a writer, is you really get to I love when I get to meet my readers. It's just the greatest thing. That's why there's something so, I get personal relationships with books, and so I have author crushes, and I love to come out, and authors will go and do live events, and that's really one of those enduring, I think, pleasures of, you know, you just don't, it's not the same as if you're on the internet, although, you know, please, you know, come visit me. I'm on Twitter, I'm on all those things, but come in person too if you can.
Well, Annabelle, I tell you, I know at one point when I write my first book, my wife will feel like it's the days when she had the gimmick table when I was a professional wrestler. She'd sell all my merchandise at the local events all over the country. So I told her, I said, the book, at one point when I have a book in merchandise again, it's going to happen. And she said, and she was looking at me like, please, no. But it's great to connect with people. And that's what Miami's all about, getting to really connect with the author for sure. So you good, best of luck in Miami and enjoy yourself. And I really enjoyed the conversation.
Oh, me too, you crazy person with five kids. Good luck to you, too.
So you say crazy person with five kids. Do you think I should have more? What's a vote? I'm only 41. Yes.
Oh, better you than me.
All right. Good talking, Annabelle. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Neil.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Celebrity Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor. Neil S. Haley, Facebook. LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And always interesting to interview celebrities, especially on their way up to the top, especially developing their craft and getting a big break. So I want to welcome the program celebrity Sloan Morgan Siegel. From Amazon's new series, Gordimer Gibbons' Life on Normal Street. He also was on CBS Partners and Nickelodeon's Wendell and Vinny. Sloan, thanks for calling. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. How about you?
Fantastic. Now, tell me specifically, your whole life, did you want to be an actor? Has this been something, a dream of yours?
Well, not my entire life. I was about 8, and then I was a hip-hop dancer during that period of time. And then I went to a dancing competition, and then after it all, one of the judges, who happened to be a choreographer, said, hey, you know, you got a nice look, you can dance, you have a cool personality, you should try acting. So I decided, okay, I'll give it a shot. So I tried a couple of acting classes in West Virginia, and I loved it. And the more I did it, the more I fell in love with it, and it's just become a passion of mine. And, you know, 6 years later, here I am. And it's been a blessing.
So has it been, once you saw this as something you really wanted to do, how long did it take, basically, Sloan, to get the support of your family and everyone on board for this?
Well, I thankfully have parents who support me in every way, and I thank them for that so much. And my family is really supportive of me in my dream to become an actor. And they were right on board from the minute we started to now and to the future. So that we only thought we were going to be out here for 2 months for pilot season, and well, now we have a house here, and it's been 4 years. So I say I'm living the dream, and hopefully they are too, and we're all happy. So
when you first started, you became an actor. When you were going to school and then having to take off for different things and things like that, how is it hard to juggle school and your and acting? Tell me.
Quite hard. It's a challenge to juggle so many different things, and keep them on track. School, when I don't do it one day, I have to make up for it on another or the weekend or something like that. I'm homeschooled, so that's easier for acting. But then again, you know, you got to keep track of your work and you got to persevere in that so you can, you know, stay ahead. And then when you're acting, in between shots and scenes, they'll bring you over to the schoolroom and you'll do school there. So that's a good thing. You only have to do 3 hours when you're in homeschool. And then social, it's the same thing. It's just, it's all hard to fit into one bus, but I get it done.
Right, exactly. And you get it done. What is your favorite subject? Especially because you have to be kind of focused yourself, kind of like when you practice your lines or different things or practice, you said, when you were a dancer. How do you keep your focus specifically on school, being homeschooled, and what is your favorite subject?
Okay, well, I'll start with the favorite subject. Science is my favorite subject. I really like biology, you know, animal biology. It just really interests me. And then what was the other part of the question?
So that was perfect. So biology, and how do you keep yourself focused to study? Just like you said about, you know, you have all these other things. You have your acting. You have when you were a hip-hop dancer, keeping the focus on all those areas. How do you keep yourself focused to study, especially when you're homeschooled, to say, I'm going to sit down and study science, or I'm going to do my math problems, or I'm going to read and write a report? How do you juggle those things and think about, hey, I got to stay focused, especially when my mind could be on other things?
Yeah, you really got to stay focused in homeschooling. I mean, honestly, I try really hard, and I don't know how I do it and keep on track, but, I mean, my parents help keep me on track and help keep me focused. And there's another thing. If you don't get A's and you don't move to the next grade, you can't be an actor either. So it's kind of a balance of if you don't do this, you can't do that. And plus, school is really important, and I'd really like to get a degree, and
So you want to go on to college. After this, you're going to go on to college for sure.
I'm going to do my best to do that.
Unless somehow a big break comes, right? And I'm sure your parents are listening right now to this interview saying, yes,
yeah,
you are going to college. you can pursue the career throughout college. You never know, especially with the way things work and all those
things.
Online
college.
Exactly. And you, telling people that want to be in your place, tell them how important education is to yourself as well. Understanding that your days as an actor could end very abruptly. Something can happen. The wrong break happens. You always have to have a backup, don't you?
Absolutely. And once you get out of the business, it's really hard to get back in. So, you know, it would not be a very good thing to work so hard and then have it all fail because of you know, not keeping track of school. So I try really hard to keep everything in check.
All right, we're talking to Sloan Morgan Siegel from Amazon's new series, Gordimer Gibbons, Life on Normal Street. By the way, Sloan, what grade are you in right now?
I'm in eighth grade.
Okay, middle schooler. So I'm sure you're happy.
Yeah.
You don't have to deal with all the drama that's middle school and you get to be homeschool because that can keep your focus. Because that, I'm sure some child actors, they go through that and they're like,
yeah,
oh my gosh, I went through this whole day at school. Now I got to go and act like everything's fine. So that's for sure. So tell us a little about the series, who you're playing and things like that about the Amazon series.
Well, I play Gordimer in the Gordimer Gibbons' Life on Normal Street, which is an Amazon original series on Amazon Prime Insta Video. And it's about three best friends who grow up on Normal Street where nothing is quite normal. And they soon uncover hidden and dark secrets within the street, and they acquire friends throughout the journey, and they encounter villains and myths and tales that just happen to be true. And it's just a fun family show, and I think everyone will really enjoy it. And it's coming out November 21st, and I'm really excited.
Interesting. Yeah, so playing that role, especially uncovering different things, do you think it's kind of like almost like detective in a certain way, you as Gornimer?
I guess it is, because it's basically, it's not really summertime. It's during school as well in the show. But I think they are somewhat of detectives. Well, Ranger isn't really a detective. He kind of jumps into it, and Mel kind of thinks it over, and Gordimer's kind of the one in between who jumps into it but also thinks it over. It's really cool how the three have the range and the balance of in the whole crew to be like one big detective. It's pretty cool, because whatever one doesn't pick up on, the other will.
Exactly, and in that process. So are you a fan of any of the children's detective series? Did you ever read Nancy Drew or different things like that?
I did. When I was in, I don't remember what grade, but I used to read all the Nancy Drew books, and I really enjoyed those. And I love the mystery books and all those things. So, it's really fun to portray a character in a show that really, it's not just mystery, it's every genre you could think of in one show. And it's cool how the genres kind of dance around each other and just all meld together and make such a beautiful show.
So how do you prepare for this role as Gordimer? Tell me a little bit about that. How did you, like, especially kind of, did you model certain other actors or different characters from other shows or throughout
your career?
Come up with different ways of acting in through it. You know, like saying, I take this character, what is in the script, but then putting my own spin in things and how I read it. How did you prepare for that? Tell us.
Everyone reads the script a different way. And it's fun because when I first read the script, I was upstairs in my room and I was reading it, and I just got really excited, and I ran downstairs and I said, Dad, have you read this? And he said, no, do you like it? And I said, yes, it's me. So I guess I modeled the character a little bit after, or not a little bit, a lot after myself. And I don't know who else I model it after. I create characters in my head, and then I speak, and the character has been born.
So who would you say is an actor that you look up to? Who would that be?
An actor that I look up to?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely Al Pacino, or any actor that basically has won an Oscar for a really dramatic film, or some comedic actors. I can't name them all because there are so many, but there's so many amazing, talented actors and actresses in this world. And I'd like to be one of those. So that's what I strive to be, is a talented actor.
You're looking to be a working actor that it keeps struggling through different things, but getting that big opportunity and get that Oscar someday. That's a great aspiration for sure, Sloan. You know, a lot of people look at it like, okay, I just want to be the next teen award winner or certain things. You're looking at you're setting the bar high for an Oscar. So that's good. But look at specific people. Look at Will Smith, how he developed into a more of a different type of actor, starting just with the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, and he moved all the way up to, you know, dramatic films and different things. So his character kept going through his working acting days. So you definitely can do that. So Sloan, where's the best place we can find you and learn more about you, and so our listeners can check you out and also check out the series? Where's the best places to go?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you want to learn more about me, you can just go to my website or my IMDb. The website's www.sloansiegel.com. And then IMDb, you can just look up my name on the website. But anyway, where you can find the show is November 21st on Amazon Instant Video. They will release all the shows at once, so you can just binge watch away during the Thanksgiving weekend, I think. I don't know when Thanksgiving is this year. Oh, well.
Because
my birthday is actually the 22nd, so it's the best birthday present I could ever have. But anyway, you can find it on Amazon Instant Video.
Any other news with Sloan? Any other projects coming up right now, Sloan?
Not currently. We just finished the final ADR for the show. So the show is the biggest thing in my career right now, because I'm focused on that. And I don't have any feature films at the moment, but I did finish one where I was a supporting actor in a feature film. It was a horror. It was called Voodoo Possession, and that was a fun film to do. And I've had a couple others. I have a couple shorts that go to film festivals, but I don't have anything in the future at the moment.
Well, yeah, I'm sure.
No, there might be an audition right around the corner.
Yeah, so. That's as a working actor, if you have that goal of that Oscar, you just keep auditioning and keep putting yourself out there. And you're very, very, very well spoken for an eighth grader. And I really enjoyed talking with you, and best of luck on your career, Sloan.
Thank you very much, and best of luck to you, too.
All right, take care now. Thanks again.
All right, thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. You listen to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Author's Corner on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, TotalTutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, TotalTutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. And Google Plus, Neil Haley. And always, I'm excited about the Miami Book Fair series of interviews leading up to the Miami Book Fair, November 16th to 23rd. The book fair, the street fair is the 21st to 23rd. That's when you get to meet these awesome authors and connect with all fans that love books. It's such a tremendous place, MiamiBookFair.com, for more information. And I'm really, really excited to welcome to the program the president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, Ms. Carol Stern. She's the author of I Believe in Zero, Learning from World's Children. Carol, thanks for calling, and it's an honor to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you. It's my honor.
Oh, and how excited are you about going to Miami? Is this your first time, or you've been a few?
No. I actually own a place in Florida, so I'm really excited to be able to come down. My family's down there. I get a chance to see everybody, and it is my first time at the book fair, so I'm pretty excited about that because I've heard wonderful things about this book fair.
Oh, it's tremendous. It's a great place, and it definitely has such creative authors. And what I think it honors is education. It honors books, and books. Sometimes become a pastime to some people's beliefs, but it's honored there, and that's fantastic, to say the least. Now, your book again reflects on yourself and UNICEF's mission to reduce the number of preventable deaths of children under the age of 5. Why is that so important to you, and you being involved in UNICEF and stuff?
Well, the book for me is the stories of this past 8 years where I've had the privilege, to be the president and CEO of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF. But what it really is kind of a culmination of a lot of things of my life. You know, it's kind of my story as a mom who has worked in the nonprofit for all these years, who's the child of a Holocaust survivor, whose life was saved by one woman who just cared enough to bring her here to the United States. And I grew up in a home where we were really taught, because of that one person could make a difference. And so I come to the U.S. Fund thinking I really understand the world. And for the first time, I've spent the past 8 years really traveling through the developing world and learning what I didn't know. And so one of which is the startling statistic that even today, as you and I talk to each other, 17,000 children will die today of causes we already know how to prevent. Horrific, right?
Yeah, horrific. That's again, we're talking about healthcare, living conditions, lack of food, lack of water, all the different things that we just don't even think about. And these developing countries don't, and that's terrible.
Right, exactly. Things as simple as a glass of water, or they're dying from something as simply cured as diarrhea. And these are all kids under the age of 5, and it's not the kid who dies of a disease we don't have a cure for, or the child who falls victim to an earthquake or a tsunami. These are literally 17,000 yesterday, 17,000 today, 17,000 tomorrow. And for me, as a mom, I can't even imagine the horror. I just can't. And so as I've traveled these past 8 years, I've been confronted with numbers like that. I've been confronted with holding the hand of a mom and watching a baby die 7 years ago of tetanus, a disease that 70 cents would have prevented. The medication for it under $5 would have cured the child if we had been anywhere but where we were. And you look into the face of a mom who's just lost a child, knowing that your child has, like, the greatest seat at the table back in the United States, and you just know that number 17,000 has to be brought to zero. So that's what compelled me to write the book, you know, to try to get America to see these children as children, as people.
Well, and you don't mind me giving my plug in the way of thinking of this process. I think as a country, the amount of money we spend every day on needless items that could help in this process, the fact that we waste so much and we don't understand how lucky we have it, and we constantly say we need to get the next gadget, we need to get the certain thing, by being told this is what's happening and how we can help UNICEF with these. With this problem and help the world and not just have a U.S. perspective, Carol. That's the problem. We have a U.S. perspective. We look at, well, let's look at our country and not know how far worse it is in other countries, and that literally we have to, in ways, kind of give back and say, you know, we're very lucky that we have a roof over our heads, we have clean water, we have the ability to have three square meals or four square meals. We're able to travel. We're able to be cool during the summer and be able to not get so freezing cold in the winter. All these things are luxuries that we can save some money and maybe not eating out to donate to UNICEF, or we can volunteer in certain ways, and we can really look at that perspective. Am I correct, Carol?
Yeah, it's not only about what we do or don't do with our own dollars. It's about a couple of things. One,
okay,
that children really aren't defined by borders. You know, kids don't get to pick where they're born.
Yes.
If they did, they surely wouldn't pick poverty, or they wouldn't pick a war zone, or they would pick a place where they could have access to what the world has to offer. And so that's one fact. I think the second is that, as moms, we all want the same things for our kids. That's also not defined by the borders we're born between. We want them to be healthy. We want them to be safe. You know, we want them to sleep in warm beds and dream big dreams.
Yes.
And that, again, is not an economic thing. That's just a reality of being an adult who loves a child, mom, dad, aunt, sister. You know, but those are the things we want for our children. And so to the frustration to be in a position where you want that for your child and to know that $1, for example, buys enough good, clean drinking water to sustain a child for 40 days.
My gosh, wow.
Mm-hmm. And that children are dying for lack of access to good, clean water. So when you put it down to that very basic number, you begin to understand why I was compelled to say we've got to bring this number down to zero. And I think the other important point for listeners to understand is there is this sense out there that it's a black hole. You know, you give money to these organizations and they're not making progress and these problems are never going to go away. And, you know, in the 1980s, the number of children under the age of five dying of preventable causes was over 35,000.
Yes.
And in the years since then, the world's population has tripled.
Huh.
So theoretically, if we had done nothing, over 100,000 children under the age of five would be dying from causes we could prevent. And we've brought that number down to 17. We've halved that number. So it's a huge success.
It definitely is, and you're wanting to bring awareness. I was talking about how we have to give financially, but also we have to care. We have to care what's
exactly
going on. We have to ask our government to help in certain ways. We have to bring awareness to this, that just because it's not our kids that's happening to, that we should feel this is a tragedy. Just think of, you know, tragedies that happen in the United States. We need to feel the same pain and sorrow of what's happening to children and other countries, especially third world countries, and say that we can make a difference, we can talk about this, and that's why you're doing it, and that's the truth, and to bring that awareness so that people have it, shed a tear, they feel inclined to help if they can, but also feel inclined to tell others, correct?
Correct, but also what the book is about is the stories of the kids themselves, because when I started this work with UNICEF, I thought I would go out and only see sadness and horror. And I saw a lot of sadness and horror, don't mishear me. But I also saw that kids are kids no matter where you go, that they play ball, that they sing songs, that they have dolls, that they that even in a refugee camp, a little girl will make a doll out of a rag and a stick, you know? And that the tenacity of the spirit of a child is so overwhelmingly contagious, their belief that tomorrow's going to be a better day, we can all take a lesson from that. So that there is this sense, I hope, in the book of the hopefulness that
yes.
I've gotten from the children that I've met. And so it's not an all sad book. It is the stories of these amazing people,
yes.
the amazing workers on the ground helping that put their own lives at risk and put children first, the amazing moms and dads that have trekked miles and miles to find safety for their children, or the joy when a new well is opened in a village or a school becomes accessible, or, you know, the things that, again, as you said, we often take for granted that to give a child in the desert a pencil and to know that he's going to have that pencil in 6 months when you come back. It's going to be worn down. It may be a, you know, an eraser with a point by the time you come back, but he's still going to have it because he's got one pencil.
Definitely. And I think that that's so great to see that the cheerfulness of the children at times, their lovingness, and they really that they're caring people, and that we have to think of them, and that they do have good times, but there's lots of hard times, and that we can help them make their lives much better. And that's the most important thing for sure. Carol, and the stories are heartwarming stories that you learn about, specifically things that you had to learn on your own by doing the traveling. Now we can use your lens and look through your lens and understand what you have experienced in the last 8 years.
Yeah, and to see that, you know, that none of us, definitely not me, but that none of us have all the answers, and that we all screw up and we all feel helpless, and then we also all feel pride or sadness or joy, you know. And it is just kind of the exploration of who am I and what has this meant to me, and then why has it compelled me to become a very loud voice on behalf of the world's children.
Well, fantastic, Carol. Where's the best place we can purchase the book and learn more about you?
You can buy the book in a number of places. You can buy it at any Barnes & Noble. You can buy it from Amazon. You can buy it at your local small bookstores. I believe it obviously will be for sale at the book fair. You can go on to our website and access it as well, which is unicefusa.org. The other thing that the public should be aware is 100% of the net proceeds from the book goes to UNICEF. This was a book on behalf of UNICEF.
Well, that's fantastic, because you're going to get to learn about things and educate it, and you're helping UNICEF. What a tremendous thing, and I think that you'll hopefully sell a lot of books in Miami and meet a lot of amazing people, and they'll truly see your cause and what you've done, and you should be commended for all the hard work you're doing and what UNICEF has done for years. So thanks again for calling, Carol.
Oh, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
All right, take care now. Okay.
All
bye-bye.
Right. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Author's Corner, and we'll be back in just a moment. We're back to the Total Education, Total Tutor Show on the Total Education Network. Again, TotalTutor.net for more information. Twitter, Total Tutor, Neil S. Haley. Facebook, LinkedIn, Neil Haley. Instagram, Total Tutor. Pinterest, Neil Haley. Google+, Neil Haley. And all those different areas. And I'm with Super Bowl champion, Pitt star Darnell Dinkins. And Darnell, how are you? And excited to talk about, again, the process, high school. It's a very busy time for seniors, and it's also a very busy time for juniors, because this is their most important year to kind of get things going and rolling.
Absolutely, Neil. It's always a great time, man. We've got Halloween coming up, so get to dress up as, you know, one of my favorite, you know, characters. The fall weather is here. Football is here. Playoffs for high school. I mean, what more can you ask for a guy who's involved in all these different, you know, areas? I'm excited, you know, just about the playoffs this week. All the things that's going on, and more importantly, about talking on our show today.
So yeah, it's interesting when you said about the playoffs, and this is the time of the year. So it'll be interesting to see when we talk to you in March. You'll be talking about your camps and different things like that, gearing up for summer. But at this time, your players are in the midst of their seasons. It's almost over. The hard work of all year, all training leading up to the WPL finals and all these different playoffs. It's what these players work for, isn't it?
Absolutely. You know, talking with a lot of kids, I'm a great article for any of our listeners right now. Great articles out in the Tribune Review today about some of the players that we've dealt with firsthand. One being Ben DiNucci. I'm the leading passer of the Whitfield this year. His team is undefeated. And he just really talked about what the winter conditioning program helped him with last season and how it's helped him throughout this year. But more importantly, Neil, one of the biggest things is that right now going through playoff season, some of these kids are about to face a component which is called grades in our GPA. And I think it would be good for us to touch base on a lot of things that these kids need to do, not only on the field and preparing for playoffs and for long in their playing careers, but what they need to do to prepare every single day they walk through the school doors.
Definitely. And that's really a great point when we talk about that, involving that process of grades. I say the big thing that they have to really develop, especially sophomore, junior, even earlier, but if it's this time and parents are listening, sophomores and juniors, and even seniors, develop those study skills habits, because if they want to play at the next level in college, you're going to have good study skills to even stay on the team and stay in the school, first of all, because the amount of time the kids study in college takes up most of their activities already. Add a sport that takes up all the practice schedule and all those things, it's pretty much like two full-time jobs.
Absolutely. I tell kids all the time, as a college coach, as a player, as a professional coach, I always was trying to be proactive so I wouldn't have to react. The more on top of things I was going into a game plan, knowing what happened on first down, second down, third down, the more I sat and met with my coach, if I didn't understand a piece of our game plan, the better I felt in the game when the live bullets were flying. Same thing with these kids in the classroom. You know, what kid would go into a game and not prepare, whether it's basketball, whether it's softball, whether it's soccer? We always prepare for our particular sport, but kids do not prepare the same way when they take tests. They feel like it's just going to happen, and that's one of the biggest misconceptions that you can have. There are standards just to be academically eligible for the NCAA, but right now the standard is I need a 2.0 core grade point average. Once again, we talked about a few weeks ago, those core classes are 4 years of English, 3 years of math, 2 years of social studies, 2 years of a natural physical science, 1 year of an additional English or math, and 4 years of a foreign language, so a total 16 core credits. Now, when I got that 2.0, I got to at least score 10-10 on the SAT. If I'm not being proactive with my grades, I'm making it very hard for myself, not only just to make my stay on my team and be eligible, but to be eligible for college if that's where I decide to go. So it's very important that these kids go through their classroom, create a study habit, which means if I can apply at least another 20 to 30 minutes for each one of my courses, I can then make sure that I'm benefiting myself not only in the classroom, but after the classroom. Because if you're only doing enough in the classroom, chances are you may end up struggling. And not enough kids do themselves enough service by going to a teacher if they are struggling in the course and saying, can I come early and do some makeup work, or can I come after school and do makeup work?
What's interesting when you talk about as the kind of two hats when you were, again, playing college football, all the juggling you had to do, getting your grades, getting to coaches, going to class after a long trip traveling. Now, if they learn this early in high school, they're in better shape for sure, as we were talking about before. But what did you see coaching at Rutgers and seeing firsthand the kids when they came in? How difficult was it for freshmen to be on a major Division I college program and still attend class, get good grades, and stay on the team? There was a lot of struggles, weren't there, to get to that?
Yeah, there were, but I'm going to tell you this, Neil. I'm going to be totally one-sided and biased in this conversation for this topic, for the simple fact that I feel like us parents, us players who played in, you know, right in the mid-90s, you know, it was a little tough. When we wanted to get our work done, we had to go to the computer lab or to the library, or we wasn't, sometimes we weren't fortunate enough to have a laptop. But nowadays, you know, college players coming in, they have a mandatory 10 hours of study hall. Okay, I totally get that. And there's a lot of travel involved in, you know, basketball, more basketball players than anything else. Then you got football, you got soccer, you got baseball. But there's a component that's been created to help these kids, and it's called the iPad and these iPhones. It's amazing the type of information these kids can get now with writing papers, with doing reports for school, and being able to do a lot while they're not actually at the school, which is something that we did not have the ability to do when we were in school. So, you know, even though things are harder and courses are more challenging, there's so much technology now that if a student not trying to apply themselves. I always tell the kids that I coach, Neil, can't and won't look the same. Either you can do the work or you won't do the work. But if it's not done, it looks the same to me. And what I really want the kids out there that are listening, the parents that are out there that are listening, you have to apply work ethic, because with technology, it's so much easier now. Like I said, a mandatory 10 hours of study hall the second you walk into college. And as you continue to get good grades, those hours can go down. So you may have 8 hours, you may have 6 hours, but we always encourage student-athletes to get that study hall hour. And if you need a particular course they need help with, then they'll get a tutor for you, which you know all about that side.
Yeah,
you know,
yes.
But definitely with technology, it has actually made the traveling athlete, made it a little bit more easy to get information that's needed. But the main thing is going to be, will they apply themselves? Will they prepare themselves to be successful?
So did you see, especially freshmen, or you try to recruit players that you saw that basically already understood this, so that you don't have this learning curve for freshmen, right?
When they Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, some programs, some high school programs, do a good job of implementing good study habits. They give them assignment, books to get signed, and they have different type of things throughout the week that they have to do. But not every kid's going to do that, and not every kid's going to be your 3.0 student. You're going to have some kids who are going to have to really hold their hand and walk them through the process, which is okay as a coach, because that's what you know that you sign up for that. But at the end of the day, it's always going to come down to, is your student-athlete going to take college and take his classes in high school just as seriously as they take their sport? And you'll be able to see that in the way they prepare themselves. And not enough kids, if we talk about being proactive so we won't have to react, not enough kids prepare for their tests that they have in class. And more importantly, if I got a good GPA, I'm, having good study habits, that only helps me when I go and take the most important test of my life, which is either going to be the SAT or the ACT.
Definitely. And the thing I want to stress is very interesting when you talk about that scale, that sliding scale. You get A's in all your classes, core courses. If you can get straight A's or B's, you're more likely don't have to score as well on the SAT or ACT. It's very simple.
Absolutely.
That's one thing. You could contact me anywhere all over the world. I could tutor you right now so that teaching these kids these organization skills to keep going, the amount of work that they're expecting any student right now is amazing. You said about the technology. I say there's so much more homework and there's so many more expectations that you have to decide, even if you don't like the classroom, that you have to play this game so you get to get your dreams of playing in the Division I college sports or any sport or NAIA or just getting to college at a school you might have not. Once you get there, you have to study. You have to learn how to deal with everything that's around you. So learn it now. Don't learn it in college, because then we run into these situations like what happened in North Carolina University, where there was academic fraud, and lots of universities don't frown upon that. But a lot of times kids and they'll try different things and it'll cause them to be off the team like Notre Dame did. So we
absolutely. Absolutely. And once again, it goes back to the being proactive so you won't have to react. If you're proactive in the classroom, now like you said, there's a sliding scale with the SAT. Now if I got a 3.5 GPA for the NCAA standards for my core classes, if I have a 3.5 GPA, I technically only have to score 400 on the SAT. That's just to be eligible for NCAA, requirements. That's not including the school requirements. But if you are doing yourself as a good, student, usually your score is synonymous with your, GPA. If you got a high GPA, usually you score very high. So kids need to understand that the more I apply myself in the classroom, the better off I'll be, as opposed to the kid who's really struggling and just meeting that requirement. So when the school is looking at you, the last thing you want them to say is that, this kid is not really applying themselves, the classwork's, not really good. And more importantly, it's not just about being an athlete. In college, you truly have to embody that whole student-athlete concept, because they do not play. And if you get put on academic probation after your first year, you could technically end up losing your scholarship if you're not applying yourself in the classroom.
And do you see that? And then this is the last question before we have to say goodbye for today. But did you see that at Rutgers, that there were certain students on your team that literally really had to get their mindset going and get started, or else they were going to lose everything?
I just talked with somebody today about it at one of the colleges. I'm one on when I was in school, and it goes on in every school. There's going to be some kids on the team that college classes are just a little bit overwhelming. They have to be handheld, just getting in class on time, interacting with the teachers. I think it's vital that a kid is proactive when they get to school and not thinking that these teachers really care what they do on, you know, Saturday or Friday night, but just really doing the relationship and saying, hey, here's my situation. Struggle with this test. Can I do any makeup work? But there's kids all over who put themselves in risk of being on academic probation because they're not doing what they need to do in college and at risk of really, you know, flunking out of school because they're not applying themselves. You know, a lot of times with class, it's not so much the work is so hard, but you really have to put in the time. And if you don't pick up a textbook, if you don't put in at least, you know, 10 to 15 hours your first year, it's going to be overwhelming. You can see yourself sitting on a sitting in a chair in front of the office, you know, looking at, you know, begging and pleading for your scholarship.
Yeah, definitely begging and pleading and saying, please, please allow me to stay on the team. What was I thinking? How did I do this? And I'm sure what you saw in the NFL, especially being a player rep, are the people who did apply themselves in college as a student athlete, and then the ones that didn't, that are struggling, trying to figure out their lives playing as professionals because they don't know how to really kind of function, right? In certain ways.
No, one of the key things that a lot of athletes don't realize, Neil, is that when it's all said and done, it was so funny. I really don't watch a lot of, you know, pro sports, but I happened to catch the Lakers versus the Rockets game, and they were talking about Kobe Bryant. He's 36 years old. He's so ancient. Like, you really, 30 sounds so ancient in any sport, but really, you're really just starting to live your life, and there's so much life to live after that. If you have not applied yourself, if you've not had gotten a business sense or any type of schooling, when you're done playing, you technically are just sitting there with your hands up in the air saying, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And that's why a lot of guys get into issues. You got to learn how to scale back and cut back on your lifestyle and really apply yourself as far as what am I going to do to create an income for myself right now. So a lot of guys, if they just go through school and, man, pat on the back saying you're great, you run great routes, this and that. Well, guess what? When you're 45 years old, no business is going to care how many catches you had.
Exactly. And then you see these stories and you see the people that have been successful and not, and how you, Darnell, have taken your business and also your coaching to the next level after your career was over in football. Now, the best place to find you, Darnell, where can we go?
The best place to find me is at thingsethictraining.com. You can go and see all the stuff that we got coming up. Starting December, you can register right there on thingsethictraining.com for upcoming SAT football winner camp. Once again, it's in a Tribune Review. What happened last year with a lot of the guys, two of the four of the top four teams that came, almost had over half their players. They have a combined record of something like 40-1. So they're doing very good. You can go to you follow me on Twitter at Darnell_Dinkins and see all the movement and things that were going on. Also at Ethic_training. So people can get in contact with us. They can go to our website. They can register for SAT camp. That Neil, you'll be, you know, directed firsthand on the SAT tutor phase of that from 6 to 7. And from 7 to 9, the real, you know, things are flying around on the field. We're going to teach some kids the ins and outs of football.
Well, awesome. You're doing some great things, Darnell. Talk to you next week, and we'll continue to talk about the college recruiting process, the pretty much high school. This is the time, parents, that you really have to get your mindset and get your kids really geared in, because before you know it, they'll be off to college. So good talking to you, Darnell.
Great talking with you, Neil.
All right, take care. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to the Total Tutor Show, and we'll be back in just a moment.